Second.
Mr. Boyd, the case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The next case is 98-825, Disciplinary Counsel versus Isabel Suarez. Ms. Brown.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Boyd Brown, counsel for Relator Disciplinary Counsel. Disciplinary Counsel filed three objections in this matter. The first objection goes directly to the board's opinion, and I'd like to talk about that for a moment briefly. On page 6 of the board's opinion, if you follow along with the analysis, the panel on the board appear to find that the Mazur case is directly applicable to this fact pattern. Relator disagrees, first of all, with that proposition. Second of all, the panel on the board appears to take the Mazur case, apply it to this case. The Mazur sanction was 6 months state suspension. So they compare the two cases, and then they contrast the two cases briefly, and then they come to the conclusion that in this case, the respondent's sanction should be a public reprimand, and the quote from the panel's opinion is, for not saying no to her employer. Now, Relator's difficulty with this is because it directly implies that they are sanctioning the respondent because she did not say no. In other words, she took another attorney's directive, took the funds out of the IOLTA account, put them in the business account at another attorney's direction. And that is the whole crux of our first objection, that the respondent cannot walk away. Her conduct cannot be excused because she relied on another attorney. And I think if you look at the board's opinion, you look at page 6 of that opinion, you will find that the board went directly from here's Mazur sanctioned, we don't think this is quite right, but we have to do something, so she gets a public reprimand because she didn't say no to her employer. And that is the reason for our first objection. Respondent in her answer to our objections also says that she has accepted responsibility for her conduct in this situation. I think if you evaluate the entire record, you'll find that there were brief stipulations, but there was no agreement as to a violation of 912A. Also, her counsel at the hearing asked the charges be dismissed because she acted under duress. So any way you look at it, that is not accepting responsibility for the conduct in this case.
Ms. Brown,
yes.
Is it the first objection that you just reviewed for us relates to the actually the way the panel phrased the reason for the sanction?
Yes.
But I'm wondering, even though that may be objectionable, that they phrased it that she failed to say no was really the does it really boil down to that the panel seemed to find more mitigation here than in Mazur, in the relative inexperience of the attorney, the situation of being responding to a superior in an employee role? Is that worth any, is that meritorious?
Relator believes that Mazur completely is inapplicable to this case. Because Mr. Mazur took his own personal funds, his own money, put it in his IOLTA account, and then paid his own personal bills out of his IOLTA account. So in essence, he was laundering money through his IOLTA account. And in this case, the money that was taken by respondent from the IOLTA account was never her money. Right. It was always money that either belonged to her clients or the medical providers. So that's why we believe Mazur, in this case, are apples and oranges. And in fact, that was argued by Relator's counsel at the hearing, that we did not believe that Mazur applied. And standing here today, I can tell you we don't believe.
Counsel, the points Rob and Jimmy directed their attention to what it said that you brought forth the Mazur case in an attempt to convince the panel.
The Mazur case was mentioned at the hearing by Relator, but from the standpoint of the fact that we said it did not apply. That it was not, it should not be used as, Mazur got the 6 month stay suspension based on those facts.
but you brought it up.
Yes, yes. And...
And now you don't like the way they're applying.
We don't believe it applied at all.
Then why bring it up?
I'm not sure, frankly.
Seemed like a bad move.
I think maybe from the standpoint of distinguishing it, saying this case applies, this applies, and Mazur doesn't apply. This isn't like Mazur. And that's, to continue to respond to your question, we definitely believe there's mitigation in this case. There's no question. And I think that if you look at the cases that we cited, the Miles case, the Gill case, the Lucy case, the Morton case especially, those respondents all got 1 year actual suspension. And in this case, we don't argue that this respondent should receive anything more than a 6 month suspension. There is legitimate mitigation here. Combination of her background, the duress that she was under from the standpoint of her personal life. Could she have said no to Mr. Barron when he told her to transfer the money? Yes. I believe there is testimony and there is evidence that will show that.
So your point, I think the point to be made there is that her obligation to the rules of the practice are higher than her obligation to her employer.
Very definitely. Briefly to address the question of whether 1102A4 applies to this case, which is our second objection. Relator believes that it does apply, and the reason it does apply is that anytime you have a violation of 9102A, if there is an intent to take client's money and use it for the respondent's personal benefit, you are engaging in dishonest and deceitful conduct. We're not saying that automatically happens. And respondent, I believe in his brief, will argue that we're saying you automatically have to have a violation of one if you have the other. That's not what we're arguing. For example, in the case of, in the Lucy case, there was no violation of 1102A4 found, but the court found that Mr. Lucy was inept. He didn't really understand his accounting practices. He was using client funds to pay firm obligations, and he didn't even know he was doing it. So in that sense, you've got a 9102A violation, but you don't have 1102A4. But in a situation like this, when you know those funds are client funds, and you take the money out, you put it in the firm's account, and you pay your own salary with it, that's a violation of 1102A4. And that is why, in this particular case, specifically on the facts, you have both 9102A and 1102A4. I'd like to address one more point that is raised in the respondent's brief, and then I would reserve some time for rebuttal. The respondent suggests that the relator must prove by clear and convincing evidence to this court that the panel and the board's recommendation is wrong. Relator submits that that's not the correct standard of review, since the earliest case I was able to find was 1909, but this court has been reviewing disciplinary cases on a de novo basis. We don't need to prove by clear and convincing evidence or manifest weight or abuse of discretion. This court takes the evidence as it is presented and gathered by the board in that recommendation and does a de novo review and makes a recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Mr. Greer.
May it please the court, I'm David Greer, and I represent the respondent, Isabel Suarez, who is with me here in court this morning. The real problem, it seems to me, with the objections here is the failure to observe that the disciplinary process is a two-step process, and that there is a line to be drawn between the issue of was there a violation of the rules and the issue of what sanctions should be imposed for that violation. I don't think that the board's recommendation can be misread as saying that there was no violation here, or that there was no responsibility, or that the fact that Ms. Suarez has stipulated every fact relevant to her conduct is not an admission of her responsibility. At page 4, where the board places its conclusions of law, it specifically finds that Ms. Suarez violated 9102A. And there's no question about that. The issue in this case was, okay, once we're past Now, what do we do at the next step, which is what sanction do we impose? And the rules give a broad range to the board and to this court. And I suppose when you talk about what sanctions are appropriate, the role of a judge is to look, A, at the circumstances surrounding the offense, and B, at the circumstances surrounding the time when the sanctions are being imposed, to try to evaluate the human being that you're called upon to sanction. And in discharging that role, it seems to me every time the judge does it, you have to go back to the historical and philosophical bases for sanctioning anybody for anything. The first one is retaliation, the Old Testament eye for an eye. And I like to think, after being in this profession for some time, that that's not a very important basis for imposing sanctions. The second is deterrence, and that's a two-pronged thing. One, how do we deter others from indulging in the kind of conduct that resulted in the violation? Two is how do we deter this individual? In this case, the evidence, I think, was clear, and indeed it's acknowledged in the brief in support of the objections here. At page 8 of that brief, it says, the evidence in this case establishes that the respondent made the transfers so that she could continue to have a job at the firm during the pendency of her child custody case. This is a mother who was faced with losing her job, losing her, and more important than that, losing custody of her young child, and a whole series of circumstances that are set forth in mitigation in the court and the evidence. So I don't think there's any concern about deterrence as far as this individual is concerned. And if we look at the other prong of the deterrence basis for imposing sanctions, I don't think there is any nuance or subtlety or difficulty in the understanding among the lawyers of Ohio that you're not supposed to invade trust funds that belong to clients.
This is an economic, this conduct has obviously economic consequences. Does a public reprimand say to, not to Ms. Suarez, I assume she's learned her lesson, but to other lawyers that if you get a public reprimand for taking funds from the IOLTA account, say it's for to operate your office for a substantial amount of time, balance that against public reprimand. Maybe then balance it seems smarter to use the funds in a distressed situation and suffer public reprimand. If it's time out, then the practice, maybe the lawyer thinks about it a little more seriously. Is that a factor we should consider or not?
If this were the only case that this court had ever considered where somebody invaded trust funds, sure, that would be a factor. But there's lots of cases this court has considered, and the Bar of Ohio is fully aware of the suspensions that have been imposed for invading trust accounts. And I don't think there is another reported case, major or anything else, that involves the unique circumstances of this case. The thought that giving Ms. Suarez a public reprimand will send a message to lawyers in Ohio that they can invade trust funds with relatively low sanctions if they are about to lose a child or anything. I don't think there's any conceivable nexus between the public reprimand in this case and the philosophical and historical goal of imposing sanctions of deterring others. Everyone in Ohio is aware. In fact, when I started practice, unless you committed a crime or you invaded trust funds, those are about the only two things that ever get you into disciplinary trouble. It's a little more complex as the years of sophistication have increased, which is a wonderful thing. But I don't think this case sends any false message to the Bar of Ohio. The third purpose of sanctioning is the rehabilitation of the offender. In this case, the circumstances that were considered in mitigation, aside from that the circumstances that surround the event itself were really two pretty important circumstances. This young lady has things that she can do for the bar and do for the citizens of this state that are a little different from some old guy like me or somebody who's in a routine practice of representing wealthy clients or people who are simply going through the mill of justice. She speaks Spanish and serves an element of the population that is underserved by lawyers. She has a commitment to the juvenile court. We talked about a sanction for her. Public reprimand has probably cut off her dream of someday becoming a juvenile court judge. In any event, she is committed to those people in a system that pays lawyers $40 an hour for out-of-court time, $50 for in-court time, a maximum of $175, no matter how complex the case is, or whether you're stuck as the guardian ad litem for some troublesome child until that child reaches the age of 18. That's a rather underserved need, and it takes somebody with both heart and courage to take the beat that it is to deal with those families and those children. And that was part of the mitigating circumstances. Ms. Suarez does not make much money from the practice of law. And to take her out of that practice is probably to take her out of it. If we look at the other issues in here, on the issue of the finding of the board that there was no violation of DR-1102A, that board had the opportunity to hear all of the testimony, to view the credibility of the witnesses. The issues that are required to be found or proven by clear and convincing evidence under that rule are dishonesty, fraud, deceit, misrepresentation. The board saw the witnesses, assessed their credibility, and found that that had not been proven by clear and convincing evidence. I think, regardless of the de novo review that may be available in this court, with all due respect, this court has not had that opportunity.
Those
are not issues that can be decided in the abstract.
Is Mr. Burns' case still at the board, do you know?
You know, I don't know far as I know.
You don't represent
him. Mr. Buren has disappeared from all known quarters. As I stand here today, based on all that I know, neither I nor anybody else in the bar knows where Mr. Buren is. The last argument, the last objection that was raised, I do feel that they're saying it ought to be an automatic suspension. And I guess my answer to that I've already espoused here to you. I just don't think that we should ever let ourselves slip into a pattern of conduct where sentencing becomes just rote sentencing, where we take the human element completely out. Certainly consistency in sentencing is important in sanctioning professionals as much as it is in the criminal law in general. But once we erase the individual circumstances, the mitigating circumstances that should be considered to have true judging of human conduct, then I think we're into a realm jurisprudence that I would prefer not to begin.
Thank you, Mr. Greer. Ms. Brown, you've saved 7 minutes of your time.
Thank you. In this case, the relator is not asking for rote or automatic suspension under 9102A. I think you'll notice that in our third objection, we said that regardless of whether this court finds that she violated 1102A4, we still believe that under 9102A, in this particular particular case, under these facts, a suspension is warranted. I believe that we have to look for guidance to previous cases decided by this court, and when you look at cases like Morton and Gill, you will find that this court has made statements such to the effect that if you misuse a client's money, you receive anything from 1 year to an indefinite suspension. This is clearly a case, and it's not denied by the respondent standing here today, that she misused a client's money, placed it in the business account in order to keep the firm operating. So at that point, we're at least, under any analysis, at a 1 year actual suspension. And in this case, we are very cognizant, very aware of the mitigating factors. So you drop from 1 year to a 6 month suspension. None of this is done in a vacuum. However, we must be very aware of the previous orders of this court, the previous decisions. And we take the facts of this case and we fit them into existing case law, and it comes out to be a suspension. Now, whether it's a year or an indefinite, or in this case, a recommendation of 6 months, that's where we are in this case, is a recommendation of 6 months. To respond to Justice Moyer's question about whether a public reprimand says enough about the disciplinary system in Ohio, and we believe it does not. A public reprimand is reserved for other types of violations. It is not to be used in cases where a respondent has taken a client's money that was entrusted to that respondent and misused it, fully knowing that they are misusing that money. If this was a mistake, if the respondent did not know those funds were earmarked for medical providers for her clients, then we'd be arguing something different. That's not what we have here. We have an intentional action, taking the money out, paying for her bills with that money. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn the court.
All rise.